And here is Dr. Eric Frederick Goldman, historian, writer, moderator of NBC TV's Open Mind program, and Princeton University professor.
I've always been struck in the case of Mr. Kennedy by the fact that in foreign policy, he seems to me to represent a step forward beyond mere containment and mere coexistence. Kennedy seemed to me to represent the next stage in which you accept containment, accept coexistence, accept massive foreign aid, but try to go about it critically and to develop new and imaginative techniques within it. To me, the president had just started that policy, and I suspect that had he gone into a second term, we might have seen some very, very new, fresh, and imaginative techniques in the foreign field. What I sensed was a questioning of the whole simple thesis that merely by giving foreign aid to any country which seems to need it and which is opposing communism, we are achieving some good. There was a drive for sophisticating the thinking within that context, very much so, I think, with the administration.
The president, John F. Kennedy, was on a serious speaking tour when he was shot down on the day before yesterday, the 22nd of November, 1963, in Dallas, Texas. 4 days earlier, on November the 18th, he was in Florida to address business leaders. But he took time out at the Tampa airport to deliver himself of these frivolous remarks.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've been making nonpartisan speeches all day, and I'm glad to come here as a Democrat and express my pleasure. If there are any Republicans here, this is a Democratic message that I'm about to give. I want to give them fair warning. Woodrow Wilson once said that a political party is of no use unless it's serving a great national purpose. I believe that the Democratic Party in this century has served a great national purpose. Here in the state of Florida, here in this county, and here in the United States.
From Florida, the president, his wife, and official party flew to San Antonio to start a final fateful trip to Texas. Among the newsmen traveling with Mr. Kennedy was NBC's Robert McNeil, who tells about that motorcade through the streets of Dallas shortly after noon on Friday, November 22nd.
The motorcade could not have started off in a gayer mood. The president had been in extremely good form all during the Texas tour up to that point, and his good humor was reflected in the press corps as they went with him. It was also reflected in Mrs. Kennedy, who had emerged with quite a new image during this tour. She, of course, had quite a name for being shy and retiring in politics. Her few appearances during the 1960 presidential campaign had not been repeated, and this was her first real emergence as a professional-seeming politician's wife, and she really seemed to enjoy the role. In Houston, in the hotel in Houston on Thursday evening, she delivered a short speech in Spanish to a crowd of Latin American Texans, and her delight in her opportunity to do this was very evident. Later, when she and the president went down in the elevator, I got into the elevator with the Secret Service men, which was next to them, and was right behind Mrs. Kennedy when she walked out through a very crowded lobby. Previously, she would have walked through very serenely, but having very little contact except with her eyes and her smile with the crowd around her. But on this occasion, she went over to the rope barrier behind which the very enthusiastic crowd was waiting, and she shook hands, moved over and shook hands with them very deliberately. After Houston, the president moved on to Fort Worth, and again he was in extremely good form. The morning of Friday, November 22nd, was rainy. It had been arranged that the president would go to a Chamber of Commerce breakfast, but such a large crowd gathered outside his hotel before the appointed time for the breakfast that and there was such a clamor that He arranged to go across the street, and he went out in the rain. He looked, he had a sheen of fitness and good humor about him. His eyes were sparkling. He looked very rested. As he came out into the rain, his hair, which is normally somewhat unruly, still looked slightly damp from having just newly combed it down. He bounced up onto the platform. He was cheered by the huge crowd which was waiting there in the rain. And he made a joke which delighted them. He said, Mrs. Kennedy is not here because she is still arranging things. It takes her longer than it does us. That's because it's better looking. She's better looking than we are. The crowd just went into delirium with this. He bounced down off the platform. He went over and he shook every hand within reach all the way around the perimeter of the barriers. And the Secret Service men had an extremely difficult time keeping the hordes of people back from him. He went back to the hotel. He stopped. This was described as a non-political tour, but President Kennedy, who had politics in his blood, who delighted in his ability to win people on the stump, he stopped on the way back into the hotel, and there were four cowboys there, or cowboy people looking in cowboy dress on horsemen. They were actually deputy sheriffs of Fort Worth. And he went, he shook hands with each one on his horse, and he went into the hotel. There were more cheers, and he went in to speak at the breakfast. His set speech at the breakfast was a strenuous defense of the TFX fighter plane contract, which has brought much of the potential of much prosperity to the city of Fort Worth if the contract is fulfilled as planned. And he received a thunderous ovation when he made this defense of the contract. All the time the people on the platform had been introduced, there were Vice President Mrs. Johnson, the Governor of Texas, John Connally, and Mrs. Connally, various congressmen and their wives. Mrs. Kennedy was conspicuous by her absence. And as all the introductions went by one, everybody began wondering, where is Mrs. Kennedy? Well, it turned out, a few whispers went around, that Mrs. Kennedy was just outside the banquet room, standing like an actress in the wings, waiting with a Secret Service man on either side of her, waiting in a vivid pink suit, a suit that was later to become very famous, in a matching pillbox hat, her eyes sparkling almost with mischief. I went out and watched her standing there, and at the appointed moment, the chairman got up and introduced her. She walked a long way. It took her about almost a minute to walk through this cheering crowd and up onto the platform. It was a very calculated entrance. She delighted in it. The president delighted in it. The crowd did. And one had the feeling that what people had been saying, that Mrs. Kennedy was the president's secret weapon for 1964, that there was some truth in this. There was a White House official standing beside me. He did, at the time, he said, he described the entrance as tactical. The president made another joke about this, and this reinforced the impression that Mrs. Kennedy was going to be a very big part of the campaign in 1964. He said, 2 years ago when I was in Paris, I said that I was the man who accompanied Jacqueline Kennedy to Paris. I feel like this now on this tour of Texas. And the audience greeted that with a delighted roar. So Friday began on a very gay note, a note of confidence. As they came out of the hotel to move off to the airport, and we waited there, the rain had stopped. A brilliant Texas sun came out. There was a vividly blue sky. There was a crispness in the air, and a crispness about the president and Mrs. Kennedy. I was reminded very much, thinking of the what he had said about Paris, because I covered the Kennedys on that trip in Paris in May 1961, and I was reminded very much of the first day they arrived there, when they took the French capital by storm with their youth, their vitality, and the sort of etched lines of their personalities in that bright sunlit atmosphere. And it was like that as they set off for Fort Worth Airport. We got out there just a little bit ahead of them, the press. We got into the press plane, which was a Boeing jet, and settled down for the incredibly short 8-minute jet ride to Dallas, which is just over 30 miles away. Everybody was gay, in good humor. We were looking at the speech which the president had prepared to deliver in Dallas, which was a stern and very forcefully worded rebuke to people on the extreme right who had been feeding what the president called nonsense to the American people, and he appealed to the American people to stop listening to such nonsense, that words were not the things to go by in the menaces which faced this country. We landed in Dallas. We got out of our plane and took our places just in front of the huge crowd there, just as the president's jet rolled up. They came out of the jet again with this almost aura of vividness about them. Their colors of their clothes seemed much brighter than they had before. This is a sort of after impression. But Mrs. Kennedy came down in that pink suit, and as she came to the bottom of the steps, she again reached out eagerly to greet people, whereas it wasn't so long before that she was quite shy about it. She was handed a bunch of deep red roses, blood red roses, if that's not the wrong word on this occasion, and held them against this pink suit. And she moved forward, shaking hands very eagerly with all the crowd, who were the official crowd who were there, then broke away from them again deliberately and went around shaking the hands of almost everyone within reach. And they went mad with excitement. Most of them were teenagers. And then they got into the open car to begin the drive through downtown Dallas. Now, we had been expecting trouble in Dallas. The police in this city, ever since UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson had been attacked and insulted on October 24th, when a member of an agitator spat on him and another one hit him over the head with a placard, we'd been expecting trouble because the police had. They had put on extraordinary precautions, bringing out one-third of the force, rounding up, in addition to what the Secret Service normally did, all possible agitators and warning them. The Dallas authorities were jittery. They did, the name of their city had been besmirched by the Stevenson incident. They didn't want any repetition of this. They were thoroughly ashamed of that. They wanted this, above all, to go very smoothly. It's interesting to note that Ambassador Stevenson has said after his experience here, he first warned the president not to come to Dallas. A few days later, he changed his mind and thought that he'd had too extreme a reaction.
And so the story, as all stories of humans must, and so the story of John Fitzgerald Kennedy comes to an end. The story of the 35th President of the United States.
O Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done. The ship has weathered every rack. The prize we sought is won. The port is near, the bells I hear, the people all exulting. While follow eyes the steady keel, the vessel grim and daring. But, oh heart, 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 oh the bleeding drops of red, where on the deck my captain lies, fallen cold and dead. O Captain, my Captain, rise up and hear the bells. Rise up, for you the flag is hung, for you the bugle trills, for you bouquets and ribboned wreaths, for you the shores are crowding. For you they call, the swaying mass, their eager faces turning. Here, Captain, dear father, this arm beneath your head. It is some dream that on the deck you've fallen cold and dead. My captain does not answer. His lips are pale and still. My father does not feel my arm. He has no pulse nor will. The ship is anchored safe and sound, its voyage closed and done. From fearful trip, the victor ship comes in with object won. Exult, O shores, and ring, O bells. But I, with mournful tread, walk the deck my captain lies, fallen cold and dead.
Now, like Abraham Lincoln, in whose memory Walt Whitman wrote that poem. John Fitzgerald Kennedy belongs to history. How will history treat him? He was aggressive and decisive, but all his aggression and decision went toward restraint. He restrained those who wanted to be more violent in the Cold War. And for nearly a year now, we have not lived with the fear of imminent war. He restrained those who wanted to be violent in the racial war at home. Here is historian Alan Nevins speaking on the president's use of restraint in the field of civil rights.
I think history will commend him for his realization of the fact that he had to tread a middle path between those who would yield nothing and those who would demand too much. He would have lost his battle had he taken his stand with either side.
At the very beginning of this look at the president, we heard a historian say the president was a fusion of two traditions. One of those was the intellectual tradition. His use of intellectuals in government is part of a fairly recent tradition, which historian Oscar Henlon tells us about.
The intellectuals began to get into government under Theodore Roosevelt. They were there under Woodrow Wilson. They were there under Herbert Hoover. And, of course, in the New Deal, the brain trust was a very important factor. So Kennedy wasn't really establishing an innovation by bringing down intellectuals. He recognized that there are great pools of ability in the university, ability which is especially necessary in our highly technical civilization, and he was ready to draw upon it. But in addition, as a person, he was attracted to intellectuals. I think in a way he was himself an intellectual, not only because he wrote books, but because he was interested in ideas and in their consequences. He liked to talk to people who knew, who were thoughtful. He was attracted by ideas, and this certainly was a factor that increased his reliance upon this kind of person.
The president's background and tradition was reflected in his public appearances at press conferences.
Kennedy was literate and verbal. He had an extraordinary memory for figures and for facts, and he was able to deal on that plane, on a sort of intellectual level, with the questions that came from the floor. On the other hand, he was not personally moved much by the kind of immediate personal rapport that such a man as FDR or Truman was. And so his conferences had a character that was really a reflection of his own personality.
Even by non-presidential standards, he was a good writer.
He was a good writer. I don't know that as a historian he would have ranked among the very highest level, but he was a good, competent, and honest writer, and that's a lot. And of course, he, more than most recent presidents, was concerned with the composition of his own speeches and was very verbal as a writer.
What were his liabilities? Where did he fall down as president? Mr. Kennedy, probably because he was aggressive and decisive, was deeply involved in every action taken by his administration. He was a participant as an athlete when he was young, as a writer of books who couldn't stand the passive role of being a newspaper reporter, as a legislator. But unfortunately, none of these early roles prepared him to be an administrator. Perhaps this was his failing. Perhaps this was where he fell short. Dr. Eric Goldman.
I think that Mr. Kennedy's strategies as an administrator was to be a bad administrator, which I suspect is the key to all vigorous presidents of a certain reform trend of mind. I've been impressed by the fact that in modern American history, it's the conservative who is the great administrator and who has very little policy to administer. It's the liberal who has lots of policies he wants carried out but doesn't bother much about administration. This is true of Franklin Roosevelt, let's say, as opposed to Thomas Dewey or as opposed to Herbert Hoover. I noted the other day that the president, shortly before his death, remarked kiddingly that he was going to have a hard time finding a publisher for his memoirs because Bundy and Schlesinger would be in there ahead of time writing them, but that he was the only man who really understood what had happened in his administration. And I think that's right. It was all so personal and, in a sense, so helter-skelter compared to the rather neat structure of an Eisenhower. I say none of this in criticism because from the context in which I'm putting these remarks, I'm very skeptical of great administrators myself.
President Kennedy will be remembered for a great many things, for his innovations in the field of foreign policy and reducing things like the Peace Corps, the Alliance for Progress, trade expansion, for reducing the tensions of a Cold War which had become almost excruciatingly suspenseful, and for insisting that the word equality means exactly that. But there was something else, something not easily definable. Call it verve, call it élan, call it vitality. It was there. Sometimes it made the very atmosphere electric.
Mr. Kennedy made the executive office exciting. He made it glamorous. He brought back to it some of that excitement, some of that prestige that had been associated with it under Franklin Roosevelt, particularly. With Kennedy's election and with the inauguration of the new administration, a stir of excitement went through the whole country. As you will remember, thousands and thousands of young people flocked to Washington to take part in the great adventure which opened up again before them, just as they had flocked to Washington in 1933 to take part in a great adventure. And by restoring significance and excitement to politics, and by enlisting the young of all ages, the young in spirit, the young in heart, the adventurous, the experimental, he added a new dimension to the politics of this particular generation.
The politics of this generation are stamped indelibly with the character of President Kennedy. Unfortunately, perhaps, the man best able to interpret that character is now gone. For it was the president himself who best knew his generation, who best understood what really went on during his all-too-short administration. Perhaps history will never be able to learn everything it needs to know in order to put him in his proper rank. Where will history rank Mr. Kennedy among presidents? It is probably too early to say. But we ask a couple of historians to speculate whether they would put him in the first rank among great presidents. Here is Gerald W. Johnson.
I would put President Kennedy unquestionably in the second rank, perhaps high up in the second rank. Kennedy cannot be evaluated at this moment. It's too early. But as a guess, I would allow him rank in the second division and pretty high rank at that.
Here is Henry Steele Cominger's answer.
President Kennedy brought a great deal to the presidency. He belonged very clearly in that category of strong presidents whose previous representatives include Washington and Jackson and Polk, Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt and Truman, rather than in the weaker or more retiring presidents. He believed that the president was and should be a national leader. He believed that the president was and had to be a party leader. He believed that it was up to the president to formulate policies and to win public approval for those policies.
The final judgment, perhaps, belongs to the man himself. For it was John Fitzgerald Kennedy who set his own goals in his inaugural speech on January 20th, 1961.
Now the trumpet summons us again. Not as a call to arms, though arms we need. Not as a call to battle, though embattled we are. But a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle, year in and year out. Rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation. A struggle against the common enemies of man. Tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what America will do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
And what is it like in Washington tonight? What was it like in the capital of the United States today as people come from all over the world to pay final homage to President John Fitzgerald Kennedy? Here is Ellie Abel of NBC News.
It took the violent death of America's president to bring together tonight here in Washington more crowned and uncrowned heads of nations than have ever assembled before in the United States. All afternoon and well into the night, their jets came screaming down to land at Dulles International Airport in suburban Virginia, came to join in this hour of national grief and shame with the American people. Most of them are silent. They feel, as President de Gaulle of France made clear on his arrival this afternoon, that they would consider it in poor taste to deliver statements. Their presence alone is an act of condolence, and they come from every continent, from the ancient centers of Europe and Asia and Africa and South America. A few did have something to say, and some of those words are worth reporting. The Prime Minister of Norway, for example, Einar Gerhardsen. I know a number of Norwegians, he said, who lost some of their closest family and didn't have a tear in their eyes. I saw these people weeping at the news of the death of President Kennedy. Nor is this show of grief limited to such staunch friends and allies as the Norwegians, the British, or the Italians. The Vice Premier of Poland, doubtless a good communist, made a point of telling reporters on his arrival that his visit was not just a diplomatic gesture. The assassin, said Vice Premier Piotr Jaroszewicz, here from communist-ruled Poland, the assassin aimed not only at the body of John F. Kennedy, but at the ideas and the ideals which the president many times expressed. That's why he was here, he said. Jean Monnet, chief architect of Europe's reconstruction and father of the common market, said, the death of the president has caused a deep sadness all over Europe, not only because he was president, but because of the tragedy of the whole affair. Representing the Shah of Iran, his brother, Prince Golan Reza Pahlavi, said, it is a pity that I come to the United States on such an occasion, because I know the whole world is sorrowful. He worked so hard for peace. And so it goes. Traditional enemies arrive one after the other to join in mourning. The President of Israel and the Foreign Minister of the United Arab Republic. The sister of India's Prime Minister Nehru, Madam Vijaya Lakshmi Pandit, and the Foreign Minister of Pakistan, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. They keep coming, the allies, the neutrals, and those who, in the late president's words, would make themselves our adversaries. For example, Anastas Mikoyan, the wily old survivor who served Stalin and now Khrushchev, first deputy premier of the Soviet Union, expected tomorrow from Moscow. President Johnson will be meeting at least the heads of these national delegations after the funeral late tomorrow. But first, the young widow, Jacqueline Kennedy, will receive them, her final White House reception. Mrs. Golda Meir, the Israeli foreign minister who grew up in Milwaukee and has been a frequent visitor, found this a heartbreaking visit. It seems too terrible, she said, for words to express. And the foreign minister of Brazil, João Augusto Araújo Castro, mourned the president. The world, he said, has lost a great leader. Willy Brandt, mayor of encircled West Berlin, arrived with tears in his eyes. The people of Germany, he said, feel very sad. They share the mood of the American people at this tragic moment, but Berlin and the American people will stick together. That was the comment of Mayor Willy Brandt. Most of the visitors will be gone by tomorrow night or Tuesday. Gone like West German Chancellor Earhart. He had been scheduled to come on a happier mission. Had President Kennedy lived, he would have arrived today for a business visit, one of those periodic Allied consultations in which, for the first time, Earhart was to have taken the place of the venerable Konrad Adenauer. Now it is a briefer, sadder mission, but like the thousands filing through the Capitol under the rotunda tonight, these leaders of foreign nations wanted to be here, wanted to be part of this moment of national grief. Ellie Abel, NBC News, Washington.
Among other notables since arrived are Prince Philip of England and Prime Minister Sir Alec Douglas Hume. We will continue in a few moments with The Highest Price, the life and times of John F. Kennedy.
We pause now 10 seconds for station identification.
This is WMAQ and WMAQ-FM in Chicago.
And now, from a name and a voice well known, another assessment of President Kennedy.
This is Mel Allen. This reporter found himself with an open weekend and following the weekly gridiron goings-on and took off for a quick fishing trip to Nassau on British soil. Late Friday afternoon at nearly 5 o'clock, returning to the dock, I suddenly noticed British flags at half-mast. I turned to the skipper of the little fishing boat and asked, "Those flags weren't at half-mast when we left a few hours ago, were they?" He, as well as I and my companion, were unsure. And so it was that on the waters of the Atlantic, we stopped a sailboat headed in the opposite direction. Hailing its skipper, we asked if he knew why the flags were flying at half-mast. He yelled across the open water, "President Kennedy has been assassinated." A shocked, stunned group suddenly burst out, "My God, no." And silently we hoped that he was mistaken. And thus it was that just a few hours ago, I stood almost on the very spot where President Kennedy stood to be welcomed by the then Prime Minister of Great Britain, Macmillan, in the historic Nassau Conference. Flying back to New York to participate in this tribute to our late president, my mind wandered to the time it was my privilege to have met him not quite 2 years ago when he attended the National Football Hall of Fame Foundation dinner here in New York to pay tribute to many outstanding American citizens who, like President Kennedy, in their youth were athletes in their college days, and to pay tribute to sports in general. I recall that he seemed so relaxed in an atmosphere that held great appeal for him, even to the extent that he insisted on a program for all Americans, which he fervently urged them to follow, his physical fitness program. And I was proud to have been a member of his physical fitness committee. As he said, to be strong intellectually and spiritually, we must develop and utilize our physical skills. We are an under-exercised nation. But he thrilled the spectator sports as well. He threw out the first ball to inaugurate new baseball seasons. An avid football fan, too, he recently recalled his 21st birthday, not because he had come of age and was eligible to vote, but because it reminded him of a football game. "Many of my boyhood heroes," he said, "were football stars. And I can tell you from personal experience that even as President of the United States and until he drew his last breath, many of his heroes still were from the world of sports."
A touching story of love and devotion, as reported by Bryson Rash.
Shortly after 9 o'clock, Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy, accompanied only by her brother-in-law, the Attorney General of the United States, Robert Kennedy, came here to the rotunda. The two of them went inside the rope as they came up the great stairway in the east portico. Recognized by police, and the crowd was moved aside, the great crush of people, so that these two people could come into the rotunda. They went inside the velvet-roped-off area where is the catafalque and the casket in which the body of the late president rests. Mrs. Kennedy alone went to the side of the casket. She genuflected, touched the casket, and the flag that drapes it turned and departed. Her eyes were moist. The Attorney General met her halfway, took her arm, and led her back out through the crowd, through the portico. She stopped several times to accept the well wishes of several ladies in the crowd as she walked by. Her appearance was an emotional peak which triggered tears among many of those standing by. The two of them then walked out of the out onto the east portico, and a handful of reporters had spotted her and started out immediately after her. The Secret Service man turned to us and said, "Please keep a respectful distance," which we, of course, did. The two of them walked down the great staircase where just a few hours earlier the body of her husband had been borne and placed in its point of respect. They walked down the staircase, and at the bottom was the big limousine ready to take them back to the White House. Mrs. Kennedy shook her head and said, "No, I would rather walk." The two alone set off across the darkened plaza. They walked across the little grass strip there, and behind them, one Secret Service man, several Capitol policemen. There was no one there, of course, but as they got beyond the Senate wing of the Capitol building itself, they turned left and plunged through a large group of people that were milling about on the sidewalk. They were not recognized. Mrs. Kennedy wore a black dress, a black coat, and a black scarf, which was pulled back from her face. Again, followed by the Secret Service men and two or three Capitol policemen, they walked down Capitol Hill. This meant they walked over grass under trees, dodging between parked automobiles, and then dodging between parked automobiles and no sidewalk, of course. Many people were coming up Capitol Hill, and they did not recognize Mrs. Kennedy nor the Attorney General. This included several Capitol Hill policemen. They finally got down to the bottom of Capitol Hill, at first in Constitution Avenue, and there people began to recognize them. They stopped for just a moment, and another well-wisher came up to say hello. And Mrs. Kennedy paid her respects. At the moment, walking into the rotunda is the President of Ireland, Eamon de Valera. He is accompanied by many of his officials. The President of Ireland has come to the rotunda to pay his respects to the late President of the United States. There was a large group of gentlemen with him.
Rusk.
Secretary of State Rusk is among them. The Irish Ambassador, Mr. Kiernan. The President of Ireland, accompanied also by the United States Ambassador to Ireland, Mr. McCloskey. They have paid their respects, and now they walk off to the right. A large group has just come into the rotunda, headed by the President of Ireland, Eamon de Valera. With him is Secretary of State Rusk, and the Irish and the United States Ambassador to Ireland, Mr. McCloskey. They stand for a moment and talk. And now they walk back across the rotunda and are making their way out of the building. Throughout the evening, there have been a number of these visits. Dignitaries of many nations and of all walks of life have come to pay their respects to the late president. But now, to return to the story of Mrs. Kennedy's outing, at first in Constitution Avenue, they had been recognized by this time by perhaps 20 people. They fell in behind the police and the few reporters, and the Attorney General and Mrs. Kennedy then turned and walked south on First Street. They met a large group of nuns. Mrs. Kennedy stopped for a moment to accept their condolences, and she thanked them. They walked on farther south on First Street, and at this point, the Attorney General said something to Mrs. Kennedy. She nodded in agreement.
The traffic is extremely heavy on the streets in this area, and the Secret Service man called police. Traffic was stopped, and the Attorney General and Mrs. Kennedy then weaved their way through the stopped traffic to the limousine that had followed them down Capitol Hill, and they got into the limousine and went back to the White House. This moment of privacy, alone in a great throng of people, while Mrs. Kennedy, had lasted perhaps 16 minutes. The amazing thing about it was that so few people recognized her, and secondly, that she made this walk and visited this area with such a small amount of protection. The respect of the people who did recognize her was enormous. They kept their distance and permitted Mrs. Kennedy, the widow of the president, and the president's brother, the attorney general, to be alone in the midst of this great crowd. Later in the evening, perhaps an hour after Mrs. Kennedy had visited here, four ladies of the Kennedy family also came to the rotunda to pay their respects. Mrs. Rose Kennedy, the mother of the president, Mrs. Eunice, Ethel, and Joan Kennedy. Miss Joan Kennedy is the wife of the senator. Ethel is the wife of the attorney general. Eunice is the wife of Sergeant Schreiber, the director of the Peace Corps. The four of them came. They went inside the small enclosure where the catafalque and the body of the president lies, and kneeled, and for just a moment, recited a silent prayer, and then they too left. A moment ago, the president's brother-in-law, Stephen Smith, appeared here to pay his respects. Apparently, throughout the evening, there will be other visitations by members of the Kennedy family and by close friends and by relatives, members of the family. This is Bryson Rash reporting from the rotunda.
A reporter well acquainted with the new president, Lyndon B. Johnson, the successor of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, is NBC's Robert Abernathy, and here is his story.
I was talking one night with Lyndon Johnson's longtime assistant, George Reedy. It was just after the man who is now president had surprised many of his friends and agreed to John Kennedy's request that he run for vice president. What kind of man is this, I wanted to know. I had watched him as majority leader of the Senate, standing with his hands in his pockets by his front row desk, speaking so quietly we in the gallery could hardly hear him. I'd known his reputation as a persuasive Senate operator, a man who knew his colleagues instinctively, knew how to reward them or threaten them or plead with them to get something done. I'd known his reputation as a rather flamboyant Texan. But what kind of man was he, really? George Reedy, I knew, was one of those many persons who've worked for Mr. Johnson for years, endured much, long hours, sudden changes of plan, and yet developed fierce loyalty to their boss. George Reedy, I knew, was by no means an objective source, but he had something important to say. I believe it more today than I did then. I've learned to agree with him. The senator, said George Reedy, speaking of the man who is now president, is like a combat general. There's much truth in this. Don't think of a chief of staff or a Pentagon planner. Think of a battlefield commander, perhaps a George Patton. Lyndon Johnson is tough. He admires power and its decisive use. As a congressman on the Naval Affairs Committee, as a senator on the Armed Services Committee, its Preparedness Subcommittee, and on the Space Committee, he has been concerned with national security. He is proud of the process of our government, and as majority leader of the Senate, he often seemed more interested in getting action than he did in the precise nature of the action. He can be expected to command and to lead. The questions then are, can he lead and in what direction? Taking the second question first, the question of direction, those who know Lyndon Johnson best doubt that there will be any major change in foreign or domestic policy. When he was a senator from Texas, Lyndon Johnson got a conservative reputation. He was representing his generally conservative state. But when he was a congressman in the 30s, it should be recalled that he ran for office as a 100% Franklin Roosevelt New Dealer. And since he was elected vice president, he's been down the line with John Kennedy policies, active particularly not only in space development, but also in equal employment opportunities.
Lyndon Johnson's directions can be expected to be the same as John Kennedy's. And can he lead? Certainly in those processes of government which require personal contact and persuasion, President Johnson will be effective. Effective, by the way, is one of his favorite words. He wants to make things happen. The skills he developed as majority leader of the Senate will serve him and the country well. As an executive, however, as the master of a complex machine, he may be less experienced. He operates personally. He's always had a small staff. He may find it difficult to be the chief organization man in the country's largest organization. He can be expected to become angry at bureaucracy. But the presidency is more than personal contact among men, more than executive processes. It is perhaps above all things a position requiring the ability to touch the hearts of a majority of us. I've watched and listened to Lyndon Johnson on the campaign trail, standing before a strange audience in a strange city, reaching out for them with words and stories, trying to find what will move their hearts. When he speaks ad lib, when he's with a sympathetic crowd, Lyndon Johnson can be, as he wants to be, most effective. He draws out country stories and, believe it or not, can be very funny. But a president cannot so often speak ad lib. A president must read out loud. John Kennedy was a master at this. His style was literate, polished, thoroughly educated. He was effective on television. Lyndon Johnson will not do this nearly as well. He has other gifts, many of them, but this, reading a speech, is not one of them. We will all have to adjust to this and to the difference between the accents of Boston and the West Texas hills, between the products of Harvard and Southwest State Teachers College. But once we do make the adjustment, we may find that underneath that unfamiliar twang and manner, there is a man of great strength, of great physical strength, but also of the strength of purpose which commands support. His greatest immediate problem will be to communicate this, and ours to let it be communicated. This is Robert Abernethy, NBC News, Washington.
Another of NBC's reporters well acquainted with the new first family is Nancy Dickerson.
It's always said that in America, a man can be born in a cabin and rise to the presidency. That's exactly what Lyndon Baines Johnson has done. He's truly a modern Horatio Alger. Few men have started with less. His parents could give him little more than encouragement and spiritual values. Mr. Johnson is very proud of his humble start. The little wooden frame house where he was born is smaller than the living room of many American homes, but it is the first thing he shows to all the famous guests who visit at the LBJ Ranch in Stonewall, Texas. Often, after long hours of campaigning, President Johnson likes to reminisce. He talks about those early days when he was a shoeshine boy in Johnson City. Mrs. Johnson has always campaigned with her husband. She used to be somewhat shy, but now she's very articulate on the campaign stump or whenever she gives speeches anywhere. She does know politics as well as any woman. The Johnsons love to go to their ranch in Texas. It's there that they get into their ranch clothes, they ride, they relax, they entertain their old friends, and they spend time with their two daughters, Linda Bird and Lucy Baines, both are teenagers. President Johnson loves to tease his two daughters, and they are very proud of him. They're also very unaffected, even though most of their lives have been spent in the limelight. Lucy Baines has lots of boyfriends. Linda is engaged. She may be married next summer. We might even see a White House wedding sometime next year. Mrs. Johnson is a remarkable woman. She never seems to lose her composure, even under extraordinary circumstances. I well remember the day in Austin, Texas, when 14 of us reporters reporting on the campaign landed at the airport there. The hotels were all filled. It was convention time. So Mr. Johnson invited us all to the ranch for the weekend. He called ahead to say that we'd all be there. But such surprises as that never seem to faze Mrs. Johnson. She just takes them in her stride. Her nickname, Lady Bird, was given to her shortly after she was born. A nurse looked at her and said, "Why, she looks just like a little Lady Bird." And the nickname has always stuck. Her real name is Claudia, But even in the congressional directory, she's listed as Mrs. Ladybird Johnson. Her best friends call her Bird. The Johnsons used to have a medium-sized house in Washington. Since he was elected to the vice presidency, they moved to a bigger place, a 9-bedroom mansion. They installed a heated swimming pool. It's a therapeutic measure. Heated swimming was suggested for Mr. Johnson by his doctors after his heart attack some years ago. Despite that heart attack, the president keeps such a fast and long pace that his aides have a tough time keeping up with him. And that goes for those who report on his activities, too. President Johnson loves to have people around him. He loves to talk with them about politics in peace. Since he was elected to the vice president, see, the Johnsons have entertained extensively both their old friends as well as government officials. One of their most notable characteristics is their naturalness, their ability to be in the limelight, but to be unaffected by it. This is Nancy Dickerson of NBC News at the Capitol.